We're going to spend a few minutes now in journey once again into the mind of this Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, thinking about a very important issue of justice. Life without parole has a particular sting when the sentence applies to a person under the age of 17. It's an impression of hopelessness and excess that might make sense to anyone who can even begin to imagine facing their teen years behind bars and then the rest of their lives in the same place. There are roughly 2,000 juvenile offenders, convicted criminals, convicted of murder in many cases, in the United States in this situation. But until yesterday, a sense of horror over this might have been confined to the sentimental among us, or confined to lawyers unwilling to accept this as justice. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court responded not to sentimentality, but to the hard logic of some passionate lawyers and ruled 5-4 that the mandatory sentence of life without the possibility of parole amounted to cruel and unusual punishment and is therefore prohibited under the U.S. Constitution. The ruling struck down laws in 29 states that required life without parole in cases of homicide. Brian Stevenson is an attorney and the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, an Alabama-based legal nonprofit. He argued this case before the Supreme Court. Welcome back to the program, Brian.
Great to be with you.
How did the Supreme Court respond to the logic of your argument here?
Well, we were fortunate that this was the third time we'd actually been before the court on this issue. In 2005, the court banned the death penalty for juveniles. In 2010, they struck down life without parole for children convicted of non-homicides. And so our arguments were really built on those precedents. I think it's been a difficult and divisive issue for the court. But an important issue. The United States is the only country in the world that condemns children to die in prison, and I think the excess that's represented in that kind of sentence did get the attention of many of the justices and fortunately led them to strike this punishment down.
What do you make of arguments of victims groups? Here's a reaction yesterday that was on a public radio program yesterday afternoon. Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, who leads the National Organization of Victims of Juvenile Lifers, here's a quote: "There's going to be a deluge of legislation and litigation and resentencing. Now that's been opened today by the court, and most victims' families don't even know that this has happened." Is the net effect of this, as this individual suggests, leniency for murderers who happen to be young?
No, I don't think that's a fair characterization. I mean, the court didn't even rule out the possibility of trial judges reimposing sentences of life imprisonment without parole. What the court said was an automatic sentence, a mandatory sentence, a sentence that doesn't allow a sentencer to even consider the fact that the person being sentenced is 13 or 14 or 16 or 17, cannot be reconciled with the Constitution. And as many as the court's restrictions on the death penalty and other kinds of excessive punishments has done, it has obviously provoked some negative reaction. But we've actually been really impressed by the number of victims' family members that have come out in support of this decision. There was an amicus brief filed at the court by victims and family members of victims who strongly urged the court to do what it did, which is to recognize that children are not adults and that these kinds of extreme sentences are not about making victims whole. They frequently contribute to the sense of loss and tragedy around these incidents.
Well, what should the process be? And again, you're not a legislature. You're not a lawmaker here. But, you know, this is a question of philosophical justice. What should the system do? You've suggested that part of the mission is to make victims whole on some level, although that's just part of the mission. Part of the mission is rehabilitation to young people who have made so many terrible mistakes. There's also an issue of how justice is meted out racially that you've talked about many times in the court. What should the system do here?
Well, I think the primary obligation is to produce a just sentence that recognizes the need to respond to serious crime, but to also that respects human dignity and basic human rights. I mean, in virtually every area of the law, we protect children. We recognize that there are differences between kids and adults, and child status matters. We don't let the smartest kids even drink or smoke or vote. We don't let kids join the military. We don't let them exercise the discretion that adults exercise. We have to protect kids. But in the criminal justice system, we have largely abandoned the recognition of child status, and I think that's been quite tragic. Subjecting children to adult incarceration, where they're 3 times more likely to be the victims of suicide, 10 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault, in our judgment, was cruel and unusual. And I think the inability, the unwillingness to consider child status has fundamentally undermined the integrity of our system. So I think those are the primary concerns that have pushed the court down this road. Ultimately, we have to recognize when our sentences, when our punishments are not in harmony with what we understand about human rights and dignity, and I think that's the issue here.
Ryan, before we go, take us to the faces that are most likely to be affected by this, faces of clients and individuals you've advocated for.
Well, I'm most excited about precisely that issue. I have worked with dozens of children who've been condemned to die in prison who have have basically been told they're going to die in the prisons where they've been condemned, who have lost their hope. They are disproportionately poor, kids of color. About 70% of the youngest kids who've been sentenced to life without parole are Black or Latino. And in the communities where they're from, and there is this profound hopelessness where people believe they're going to die in prison or effectively die by being sent to prison for the rest of their lives, even when they're 13 and 14, I think this is a really encouraging development. We're very hopeful that we can restore hope not only with this client community, but throughout the criminal justice system.
Brian, you're a brilliant lawyer. Don't talk like a lawyer here. Who are you going to tell there's hope now?
Well, I'm going to tell all of my clients. I've got people who are who've been in prison for 30 and 40 years, that this is a chance, that we still have to fight, that we have to believe things we haven't seen, that we can't allow people to give up on them, and that's just part of the challenge. I mean, unfortunately, we're going to have to keep fighting to do the kind of justice that we want to see done in these cases, but we're excited that we have that opportunity to fight, which we didn't have until yesterday.
Is congratulations the word you say when you win a Supreme Court case?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
And we're very grateful for that.
Brian Stevenson argued the case yesterday that was decided 5-4 that mandatory sentences of life without the possibility of parole amount to cruel and unusual punishment and therefore prohibited under the U.S. Constitution. React to that conversation. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Brian Stevenson, thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
Brian Stevenson is the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.